Shut up and sit down.
Welcome.
Welcome back to In the Context of Empire. This is your host, Matt McKenna, and I am very fortunate to be joined by my good friend, Matt Connors. Matt, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
I'm good. And this is sort of an impromptu podcast. Sometimes events or coverage of events in our media just seems to warrant a response. And this is one of those occasions wherein on Sunday, I was reading, just kind of scrolling through social media, checking my normal news updates. And suddenly I see this article in the New York Times that even the title alone warranted a little further investigation. Usually I have to dig into the articles to really figure out what exactly is going on here and what are the most strikingly inaccurate claims made. But in this article, it was pretty evident right from the title. So the New York Times put out an article titled, "An American in Ukraine Finds the War He's Been Searching For." And the subtitle is, "For an unconventional former Marine colonel, Ukraine represents the morally just war that eluded him his entire career. But how much can he and his military startup help?" So I sent this over to you, Matt. Like, when you saw that title, what were your initial thoughts?
I wasn't, like, eager to read the article, to be honest with you. It seemed like it would be just awful, and I don't go out of my way to read awful things until there's like a reason to do that.
Yeah, I joked around both on Twitter and with you and other friends that the title almost reads like it's almost like it's a movie advertisement, right? It's the unconventional Marine who's been down on his luck and now he gets to fight the perfect war, right? Like as if this is some kind of story of redemption. It's all really right there in the title. And just the very fact that it's portrayed as this former Marine, U.S. Marine, I should be clear, is searching for the perfect war. I mean, many people might find that to be sociopathic. He's looking for the perfect act of violence to perpetrate on other people. And we're going to get into this in a second, but the subject of the article is this gentleman who had been in the Marines for 30 years. So think about that. It's 2022. He retired recently, but his 30-year Marine career started in the early 90s. This guy's name is Andrew Milburn, and he's fought in places from Somalia to Iraq to Afghanistan. And this is all seen as kind of build up, and these are all kind of failed attempts to find that perfect place to fight the quote unquote perfect war. And apparently the way this article sells it is that he's found that particular perfect war and morally just cause in Ukraine.
Yeah, that's definitely how that sub-headline directly talks to us. I did the work and read the article and then read other things to try to get some grounding here. This whole idea that somehow that this guy is our hero, he's the focus of our attention for this article, and yet the language is all right there in front of us, that this guy has spent 30 years fighting in morally unjust wars. What does that make him? What does that say about him? What does that say about the U.S. foreign policy for those 30 years that he was actively deployed? And that, here he's finally arrived at one. There's this whole thing that we've talked about in different contexts of nothing sticks to the United States. Like all the bad eventually maybe finds the light of day, but it doesn't stick. It doesn't like carry into what we're doing now. It's like our bad. My reaction once I read this carefully, I had a lot of language reactions to it. The author, who I was not familiar with, I've written out a few of his New York Times pieces, trying to get a sense of like where's this guy coming from? What kind of stuff does this guy do? He's doing this thing that where, you know, he's not the one saying any of this, right? It's all Andrew Milburn saying it. You know, it's that he says that Ukraine is a morally just war. You know, not this author. This author's not like putting himself out there with an opinion on the war, except of course he is. The entire article is an endorsement of the war and a celebration of the actions of somebody like this former Marine colonel. But there's a lot of other little tricky things and very angering things he does with his language throughout this. In no particular order, he refers to those 30 years of terrible wars as blunders, foreign policy blunders. And to me, blunder is like one of those really gentle words you use to describe, like, you know, putting color clothes in with the whites and causing like a disaster in the laundry. You know, it's a blunder. It's not like, you know, this absolute destruction of Afghanistan or Iraq or any of the things that this guy is saying he was part of and that, you know, really bothered him. Right from the start, right from that language. And then this military startup as this thing, a military startup.
Right. We should have focused on that. It's in the very subtitle. They call it a military startup. You know, there's another word for this. What came to your mind when you saw the military startup?
Well, I mean, this is a mercenary group, right? And it's, you know, it's not being critically looked at. I read the letters in reaction to this article, and about 25 letters in, people started calling it the Lincoln Brigade of our times, the Lincoln Brigade of our times, that, you know, if I was 10 years younger, I would be right there with them, just as our, you know, forefathers joined the Lincoln Brigade to fight in Spain. And they're like, no, this is not the Lincoln Brigade. But in any case, I didn't know who Andrew Milburn was. I didn't know who Jeffrey Gettleman was, the author. This Mozart group, okay, language-wise. So it's explained in the article that's a response to the Wagner group, Putin's mercenary forces, or the Russian mercenary forces. But it's not just that's spelled out that way. He calls it a saucy response. To name this military startup, the Mozart Group, is a saucy response. And again, like, saucy, that's like something, that's a language, that's a word you use in other contexts. You don't use it in this context. It's like, it's the wrong word to be using, wrong kinds of words to be using to describe warfare and destruction and all the things that are happening with this conflict. There are two or three other times where he uses a word like that. The fineries of drone warfare. Like, he's instructing his recruits in the fineries of drone warfare. That's not where you use the word fineries, in my opinion. But
yeah, and, you know, again, like, I'll keep framing this as it really reads almost as a trailer for a movie. So Andrew Milburn, who was down on his luck, was still looking for the perfect war. And the story stuff, they kind of work backwards. They paint you a picture of Andrew Milburn, the U.S. former Marine. He's in this city in Ukraine saving local civilians, helping this Ukrainian woman escape a city as it is being shelled by the Russians. And then they kind of work backwards and tell you about how did he arrive in this situation. And, you know, they review briefly that his career started in Somalia, where, for I'm sure people who follow this podcast know, the United States has been on and off involved in Somalia for more than 30 years. The United States had originally supported the dictator Siad Barre right up through him essentially committing genocide against his own people. There's something called the Izak genocide. Through it, the late 80s, as the government of Siad Barre was committing mass murder against their own people, they were receiving all their weapons from Reagan because, like so many other things, they saw him as a reliable Cold War bulwark against other, in this case, other communist countries, like in this case, Ethiopia, even though Siad Barre himself proclaimed their government to be a socialist government. But, you know, in the early 90s, the U.S. was involved in Somalia. People probably remember the movie Black Hawk Down, and whatever good intentions that intervention was cloaked in. Of course, you know, the United States doesn't intervene for humanitarian reasons. There's all kinds of talk about how the U.S. had intervened in Somalia in the 90s in the interest of the Conoco oil company. And then, of course, the ongoing involvement in Somalia has been plaguing that country for nearly 30 years. The U.S. supported an Ethiopian invasion of Somalia in 2006. The United States bombs Somalia periodically today and consistently undercounts the death toll. This regularly gets exposed by investigative journalists. So the fact that they choose to start this story in Somalia is really telling about where it's going and about the kind of legacy this the quote-unquote protagonist in this story has. But I like that there's a line I picked up on here that the second time through, and it says, so now we're back in 2022, and he talks, it starts like this. After showing up in Poland last winter as a freelance journalist, he has built one of the largest private military companies in Ukraine, the Mozart Group. You know, Matt, it's just that standard career path where one goes from freelance journalist to mercenary. I don't know how familiar you are with that career path, but it seems strange to me.
Yeah, no. And also, it to me, it suggests that there's just all this money out there if you can put together the right proposal, the right package. You know, I accept that this guy is like a real gung-ho pro-war person, but he's certainly not missing an opportunity to put together a business plan. If we could come back to the way he is, the way Milburn is described in this article, the language that's used to discuss his early military activities in Somalia is really awful. Our author's words is that after some militiamen threatened his squad, he lined up a human being in his sights and for the first time in his career, but hardly the last, squeezed the trigger. And then he goes to quote from Milburn's memoir, this book that was published a few years ago. So this is Milburn talking. A primordial corner of our subconscious primes us to act aggressively in the face of danger. The knowledge that another human being threatens your survival will override in an instant years of parental guidance, education, religious observance, and all the social trappings of civilized society. Shooting someone, he says, becomes shockingly easy. And then, you know, we already know that he did plenty of that in his career in all those places, enough to feel terrible guilt. But it even gets worse when we're still trying to set this guy up with, you know, what is the baggage that he's carrying around from all these military experiences. The description of what happened in Iraq, where he comes upon a civilian bus at a checkpoint that is filled with children or includes a lot of children, and it gets fired upon by American soldiers. Just absolutely destroy this bus. And he comes running into the smoking wreckage, trying to save a young girl. He presses a bandage to a cavernous wound in her stomach, knuckles deep in blood, even after the medic came up to him and said, "She's done, sir." So this traumatic experience of warfare he's describing is Americans killing civilians in Iraq, and that left him traumatized. You know, it's like you couldn't find an article where the bad guys killed somebody. It had to be like the good guys killed somebody that, you know, I don't know. So,
and it's amazing. And he is still the protagonist in that particular instance. He's the one who feels bad, or at least he knows he's supposed to feel bad, rather, is probably a more accurate description. And in that section of the article that they described, first the death you described of where he gets to kill the Somalia militiamen, and the other one where he describes the death of this girl who had been gunned down at a checkpoint in Iraq, they're both situations in which you know, we're not mourning the victims of this. We're still seeing it through his eyes, where something happened to him. And it just like the death at the checkpoint, you know, these deaths at checkpoints were extremely common through the American occupation in Iraq. And the whole idea was, well, of course, the United States was occupying their country, and they would set up these security checkpoints. And yes, because they were occupying the country, they were often attacked. I mean, it certainly happened. And you have young soldiers, or in this case, this gentleman, not so young at the time because he's 59 now, but you have soldiers who have guns who may or may not fear for their lives, and they were often quite trigger happy. And any reason to feel nervous, and of course there were many, and any miscommunication, and of course there was a language barrier between them and the civilians, often resulted in tragic deaths of civilians when U.S. soldiers would open up fire on vehicles, killing children like the ones described in this particular article all the time. But he doesn't see the bigger picture there of it doesn't matter if these U.S. soldiers had, you know, accidentally killed civilians in this situation. By the very nature of occupying Iraq, this kind of thing was going to happen. When you occupy someone's country, you set up security checkpoints, people are going to get killed. And he doesn't seem to wrestle with the larger implications here. And in fact, I want to go back a little bit, just some of the language that's used. You mentioned the word blunders. I'm gonna repeat a small section of the article where they use that word blunders. And so this is the author of the article describing Andrew Milburn. Quote, "For Mr. Milburn, the road to Soledar," that's the name of the Ukrainian town he is now apparently defending in Ukraine, "For more than 30 years, he served in some of America's biggest, quote, foreign policy blunders, sent in to fight in wars in Iraq and Afghanistan that he didn't particularly believe in, with partners that he didn't trust, in causes that were ultimately losers from the position of a reviled occupier." Now, you already went into the whole blunders thing, right? The United States always has good intentions, and if it fails, they're never crimes, they're blunders. Now, according to the UN Charter, all of these wars are illegal. They're crimes. You know, the very basic tenet, Article 2 of the United Nations Charter, is that nations must conduct their relations peacefully and refrain from either the use or even the threat of violence. So especially in Iraq, I mean, these are blatantly illegal wars. And Afghanistan wasn't sanctioned by the UN either. The United States engaged in an aggressive war in both of those cases. We can throw Somalia, Libya, Syria. Every war the United States has engaged in since World War II has been an aggressive war. And the other thing here is this whole that he didn't particularly believe in. So they couch it in maybe he believed in the missions a little bit, but he wasn't very enthusiastic about it, with partners he didn't trust. So the implication there is amazing. It's essentially these were well-intentioned endeavors, these invasions of other countries, which could have succeeded were it not for these unscrupulous foreigners. Presumably he means the army that the U.S. set up in both Iraq and Afghanistan, and the whole thing in causes that were ultimately losers, right? They weren't losers at first. It turned out they were losers because after the U.S. occupied these countries for years, in the case of Afghanistan, 20 years, in the case of Iraq, on and off for the last 20 years. So the whole thing is couched in this idea, like you said, that A, the United States doesn't commit crimes, is not malicious, but at worst can commit blunders. Two, when these things don't succeed, they are never the fault of the United States itself. You have to outsource some of that blame to the unreliable foreigner, so you can assume a bit of racism there as well, right? It's the Iraqis' fault, it's the Afghans' fault, the armies that the U.S. set up in these countries. And they only lose eventually. They weren't losers in the beginning. They weren't crimes in the beginning. These are things that were only revealed over time.
Yeah, and there's other things going on. This author really considers himself a great writer, and you know, he can play with words. Lost cause is an expression, and generally, to be somebody who's always about lost causes. You fight the good fight. You're on the right side, but it's not going to succeed. To say that a cause is a loser is playing with that language, but also really disrespecting the people of the country that we're talking about there. In reading the article, I did it to search. Where is this town of Soledar? I don't know if you did the same. Eastern Ukraine. Okay, Eastern Ukraine. So I'm looking at it and saying, wow, this is right in the middle of the territories that have, the vote that just went on in the last few weeks to maintain independence, to create independence, to connect to Russia, whatever. The Luhansk and Donetsk region, this is where Soledar is. So this guy, Andrew Milburn, has basically got himself right in the middle of the territory that is effectively in Russian control. The area where the heavy fighting went on for these last months, where the Russians are fighting the Ukrainians in places like Mariupol, and they're doing whatever they can to destroy the military presence in the east. But so, I'm thinking, all right, so here we have a big New York Times article about what are the conditions in the east, something that we haven't really had very much of. I'm going to admit that I've not been reading the New York Times because I find it so hard to swallow a lot of the stories. But in terms of the conflict in Ukraine, it's like, well, what is happening in the East? That's the big question. What has been happening in the East? And then I realized that what we're seeing here is an article that's going to show us what's it like in the East. So this guy trying to rescue old people, to help lead them to safety in the middle of this conflict, is to me kind of an effort to add something, to put some information out there, because there hasn't been a lot of information about what do the people of this part of Ukraine think, what do they want, what has been happening, what has the last 15 years been like to live in Eastern Ukraine. That's not something New York Times has been knocking itself out trying to write stories about. So here we got this guy who's just knocking on doors or finding these people who are still there, trying to get them to leave and being frustrated when they don't want to come along with him. They don't want to join the Americans and go with the Ukrainians. And he said, you're going to leave yourself to the mercy of the Russians? And it's like, well, okay, author, New York Times guy, let's explore that a little bit. What does it mean for these people? What is their attitude towards the Russians that are in that area? In all the talking we've done about Ukraine, it was very frustrating to see people act as if everything started February of last year, that everything was fine until, Putin went crazy and tried to, rip off a big piece of territory and rebuild the Soviet Union, the way a lot of people kind of reacted to the events of February. And other people are saying, big stuff just happened. But in order to understand it, you got to, let's go back. What's been happening in Ukraine for the last 8 years? How are you upset about fighting now if you haven't been upset about fighting since 2014? And it became pretty clear to me that this article is about that question, trying to get this pro-war narrative to now include all the way back to 2014. So we're gonna have an article here about what conditions are, what's happening to people. Except we don't. There really isn't a whole lot of substance to what is written about what's going on in the East. I went further back. Again, I hadn't read this guy, and so you search for other pieces that he's written. And in late September, he wrote a piece that was about Eastern Ukraine, and its mission was basically to say this all really started in 2014. And you'd say, oh great, New York Times is finally now gonna start talking about, put this in a wider context since 2014. Except he completely just slides right over the overthrow of one president, the replacement of a president that is okay with, you know, the United States, and then he goes from there. So it's basically, to me, that these people who are trying to maintain a narrative that makes support for the war, support for the pouring of weapons into Ukraine, all the military spending that's happening as a result of this, they knew that eventually they had to be able to explain a little bit more. But it's not explaining. It comes back to that idea that, you know, if you don't read the paper, you're uninformed, but if you do, you're misinformed. one of those deals.
Well, it's all part of this, I would say, operation to salvage this war, because, like you said, people are starting to do a little research. People are starting to question this as we climb the escalation ladder. Of course, the risk of a nuclear exchange is steadily increasing, and there's this demand to like portray this as the unambiguously good war. And in fact, even in the article, once again, doing that thing that you described, where the journalist is using the words of Andrew Milburn to really put forward the narrative that the journalist himself believes. And I'll quote the article again. In Iraq and Afghanistan, he said, our position was somewhat morally ambivalent. To many people there, we were the invader. To many people, to everyone there, we were the United States was unambiguously the invader. Sorry, that's my interjection there. But here, we're repelling an invader. Here is something absolutely unambiguous. How many wars in modern times are morally unambiguous? And the fact that he can't see that this very same logic could be turned on the United States in every war that it engages in. Well, if it's unambiguous for Ukrainians to fight, and, you know, the subtext there is to kill Russians, then it is certainly unambiguous for Iraqis, Afghans, Syrians, Panamanians, Grenadians, Vietnamese, Laotians, Cambodians, the list goes on and on, for those members of those countries to kill Americans when the Americans are the invader. That is unambiguous, and yet he can't see that. And then he goes on to say, describing the war in Ukraine, it's almost like this is the war he's dreamed of, right? It's even in the title. Quote, it's a big conventional conflict. It's against the Russians, and the mission lacks the murkiness of the past wars like Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Again, those wars are only murky if you've been sufficiently propagandized to believe that these were mistakes at worst, well-intentioned endeavors at best, and not the crimes that they were. I mean, I stress this a lot, but there is no worse crime committed by any country that in the 21st century than the invasion of Iraq. There is no worse crime that's caused more carnage. I guess the Saudi bombing of Yemen, it really approaches that in the blockade. But again, that's with the total assistance of the United States. So really, there's not a whole lot to argue with if you actually look at facts and you're trying to put forward this pro-American argument, or you're trying to salvage its reputation. But they just couch everything in as, at worst, the United States makes mistakes. And this is consistent with the Times. I just want to call attention to something else they published, not in this article, but in relationship to the recent Russian, what seems like an escalation in their air attacks on Ukrainian cities. So we're recording this on October 13th. Just a couple of days ago, Russia launched a bunch of airstrikes across the country in response to the sabotage of the Russian bridge that goes from the Russian mainland to Crimea. They responded with these attacks on Ukrainian cities. In no way would I defend attacking civilian targets. I'm not defending airstrikes on any cities. But this is how the New York Times portrays the Russian air attacks. Quote, this is their tweet. The Russian missile attacks that killed at least 19 people across Ukraine on Monday were wide-ranging, but they were not as deadly as they could have been. That has renewed questions over the quality of Russia's weapons. So in other words, Russia would have killed more, and they certainly intended to kill more. I believe they killed 19 people. But we can only explain why they didn't kill more because of their weapons. There was certainly no restraint exercised on the part of the Russian command and control centers. Meanwhile, last year, the same New York Times reported on these revelations from the war on ISIS the U.S. conducted in Iraq and Syria. This is how they headlined an article. What to know about the civilian casualty files. A New York Times investigation found that the American air war in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan has been plagued by flawed intelligence, poor targeting, and thousands of civilian deaths. So translation, Russia kills 19 people. Clearly they intended to kill more and were only restrained by their own technological failures. The U.S. kills thousands, probably tens of thousands of people across Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan. These were errors. Clearly the U.S. would not have intended to kill this many people as they're bombing urban areas like Mosul and Raqqa. And we can attribute this not to any malicious intent, but clearly these were errors or intelligence failures. And it's just part of this larger trend of trying to salvage what should be unsalvageable, what should be obvious. The most aggressive nation in the world that's been at war nearly its entire existence, but literally every year of the 21st century. And we're being asked to look the other way and to act like these aren't the facts, that the U.S. isn't the prime aggressor in all these situations, and that somehow that this time it is different despite what may have been past mistakes. What do you think of that, Matt?
Yes, all of that, definitely. Back into the language of this article, a couple of different things that maybe we haven't touched on yet. His main assistant, this guy Rob, seems to be younger and therefore just, still really itching to get out there and kill people, and is very frustrated with the humanitarian dimension of what they're doing. If I can find where he, that's the guy leading the training particularly. And he says at one point, this is where they talk about the adrenaline rush. Like once you've been at war, you want to get back to war. Like that's normal, right? Like if you've had a taste of war, you got to get more of it. Both of these guys are saying, and the author is, quoting them. The author in that case isn't like, I completely agree. I know exactly what you're talking about. If you've been in any war, war is interesting, says Rob, right? And he's the one training. He knows that the people he's training are not ready to go off and be fighting in any way. They're all going to be slaughtered. He's shaking his head. That's what they can do. That's what their little military startup is about. It's about, trying to move some old people out of their houses, and it's about giving out some food. And so Rob, on the other hand, this is in the middle of the article, admitted he was struggling with his new role as a trainer and handing out humanitarian aid. I mean, how do you want to go out, he asked, with a gun in your hands or a roll of toilet paper? Obviously, you wouldn't want to go out with a roll of toilet paper. My God, what kind of man would die in the middle of a humanitarian effort? Like, you want to go out guns blazing. Like, it's crazy. But we're being presented this here that the people who are just so gung-ho with war are worthy of a profile piece in the New York Times. Because this is our war, and we just have to maintain our interest and enthusiasm for this war.
Yeah, and I'll remind you. Yeah, now if you remember 2 years ago, there was that outrage over that fake story about Russians paying bounties to kill Americans, paying the Taliban bounties so as to kill Americans. And here we are with this celebratory piece about Americans just dying to kill Russians with the desire to have some real action where they're able to actually put their fighting skills, apply their fighting skills toward this apparently just war. We can finish up soon, Matt, but I did want to point out that beyond just trying to salvage the U.S.'s reputation and trying to paint this war as the good war, it's also blatantly a call for escalation. And again, they're doing that thing where the author of the article translates his viewpoints through the subject of the article. So here's another part of the part I'm going to quote here. Quote, what's different and extremely frustrating to Mr. Milburn and some other veterans is what they see as America's caution. The Biden administration has sent billions in support and equipment, like high-tech rocket launchers that have helped the Ukrainians rout Russian forces in many areas this past month, but fearful of provoking Russia, it's not offering its best weaponry or putting advisors on the ground. I mean, that's an amazing statement, set of statements there. The United States has been providing tens of billions of dollars worth of weapons to Ukraine. They've openly bragged about having killed something like 10 Russian generals. I mean, just imagine this was going the other way, where Russians were openly bragging about having fought and killed Americans in somewhere like Iraq, in their main newspapers were profiling Russian soldiers or Russian private security forces who were begging the Russian government to send more weapons in to escalate the war against Americans. How would we view that? And it's just, it strikes me as a call for escalation. As this war needs, we've escalated to the point where how much further can it escalate without having major global conflict? It's already bad enough. Thousands, maybe tens of thousands of people have already been killed. And here's the New York Times calling for more escalation. As we know, nuclear threats are on the table on all sides.
Yeah. That trope of a military person saying that we would have won, but the politicians tied our hands. You know, the first time I heard that was people talking about the Vietnam War, the war we could have won if only the non-military people hadn't gotten cold feet. It's a scary thought.
Yeah, and, you know, as we kind of close out here, Matt, I want to read to you one last piece here where they have to close the article with this guy almost as he's the hero, of course. And they profile him almost, again, like it's like a movie. They portray him with this bravado, this kind of not give a fuck attitude, but brave in the face of danger. So here's the journalist quoting Mr. Milburn, Andrew Milburn. "We've been told that Russian special forces are planning to kidnap Americans," his financial officer said. Sorry, not him, his financial officer. He smiled and added wryly, "Try not to dress too American." The next morning, the Mozart team chugged off out of Kiev. Mr. Milburn looked hopelessly American. Baggy blue t-shirt, gray cargo pants, big sunglasses, he sat in a loud, gas-guzzling Jeep Cherokee with a hyper-black dog panting in the back. The dog, a rescued mutt named Richie, had become Mozart's mascot. So it's complete with the badass American who laughs in the face of danger even as he's warned not to look American. And to round out the picture here, Matt, he has a puppy with him, a beautiful black dog who apparently he rescued.
Yep, rescue dogs. Rescue dogs are definitely a necessary part of the story. I would encourage you to read that earlier piece from September 26th, even though it doesn't have the headline that you know grabs at you. It's making a bigger effort to maintain war support than this piece here particularly does. I guess I need to do a little more New York Times reading to not let this stuff get past me.
Yeah, and it's similar to our episode we did with Bryce Green where, you know, New York Times is seen as the paper of record. It's seen as setting the boundaries of acceptable opinion, especially for liberals and the intelligentsia. And for them to put out this article, the New York Times, in which millions of people are going to read this at a point where, again, we're at the point of escalation, where things need to de-escalate quickly. To put this out there as basically a call for more weapons and to escalate, it's just so irresponsible that I have a hard time believing that there wasn't a lot of intent behind it, that they want this war to escalate. So Matt, the article closes describing the subject, Mr. Milburn, Andrew Milburn. Quote, he walked Richie, the dog, under the cherry tree. A mother and daughter from one of the blown apart apartment buildings watched them. In her arms, the mother clutched two loaves of soft white bread. I recognize the guy with the gray hair and dog, she said. He is good. And that's how the article ends. I mean, it's really something else.
Yep. So we managed to, you mentioned the bridge in Crimea once. At the time you reached out to me to talk about doing this, I think we were watching a taped Stephen Colbert program from Monday night, in which he had a joke that just brought the house down about the blowing up of the bridge in Crimea. And all I could think was that, like, so our choice is suicide bombing or an unwitting truck driver who was sent on a trucking run, not realizing the whole truck was laden with explosives. And that's something that is playing to laughs in New York City to, you know, I don't know, 2,500 people in the audience, maybe fewer. And, you know, the innocent people on the bridge don't deserve our sympathy, but Andrew Milburn does for working out, getting past his ghosts.
Right.
Pretty messed up.
Yeah, it's like, it's this human interest story, which is serving the purpose of again, escalating this war. Yeah, that's all I got for now, Matt. I just think that people need to be aware of just how pro-war an outlet the New York Times is. And they, you know, and just because the New York Times is articulating these kinds of arguments and these and profiling these kinds of people doesn't mean that we have to take it unquestioned. We don't have to take it without skepticism. And for, in this particular article, there's great cause for a lot of skepticism. Matt, anything else to add before we sign off?
I was curious about this writer. I'm not curious enough to go buy his book, but described, he was the bureau chief for East Africa for the New York Times for a period of time. And it's kind of funny, I missed all this when it happened. When he left, they needed to replace him, and so they had a job advertisement for that position. And it was like straight out of European colonial racism. They described what they needed somebody to be able to do. We need you to cover Africa to be able to write stories about its poverty and its suffering and all this kind of thing. You know, something I thought we were past, at least the media people were aware of. That's not how you cover a place. But somebody described his, you know, that they were grateful that he was finally leaving because his work had been a mile wide and an inch deep when he touched on subjects. And it's sort of, okay, so now he's the one who's, you know, in the last couple of weeks, who's going to take on Eastern Ukraine, and it's going to be a mile wide and an inch deep, but it'll serve its purpose.
Well, he's definitely serving the purpose that the editors at the New York Times and the forces that guide them had intended him to serve. I forgot to mention, did you catch where Andrew Milburn was born?
Hong Kong?
He's a half British guy who was born in Hong Kong. In other words, he's the child of colonial, right? He is like a colonial administrator's son. So I guess it's not that surprising that he thinks in these terms.
Right. Before I realized he was at least part British, I came across the fact that he has a degree from Oxford or something like that. And all I could think of was Jay Gatsby went to Oxford too. you know, that whole thing in The Great Gatsby, where is he lying? Did it really happen? Is it true? You know, the military guy who goes to Oxford. But, okay.
Yeah. Well, everyone be on the lookout for these kinds of articles and do your best to explain to people why we have to see through these kinds of articles. Matt, if you have nothing else, I did want to just briefly mention that I just published an article on our website in the context of empire.com that I had written it a while ago, But I just got around to publishing it. I actually wrote it right after the Ukraine war started. It was about how media covers these events and how our mainstream media tends to cover crimes and violence perpetrated by the United States and how they cover the victims of that violence versus how U.S. media tends to cover the victims of other countries' violence and what narratives they tend to promote versus which they tend to de-emphasize. And the whole article is called The Triage Model of Media. And the whole purpose is that media, if it was ideally structured and was actually oriented toward reducing global human suffering, would adopt a very different method of which stories they cover versus which they do not. And that it would be oriented by the principles of medical triage, as in you prioritize the stories, first of all, which are the most serious, right? In triage medicine, you prioritize the most severe injuries. Well, we would prioritize the most severe human crises on this planet. But also you prioritize the stories which your audience has a chance to help. The same way in medicine, you prioritize the injuries which you can realistically address versus the ones that are sadly too far gone, right? You prioritize people who have a chance of surviving over the people you can't survive. In media, you should prioritize the stories in which your audience can directly affect and change the outcome of over the stories which they have less of an impact on. And there's no better illustration than that of than the broad focus on Ukraine in the moment versus, say, how the U.S. not focusing on things, the injustices perpetrated by the U.S. across the world, what the U.S. is doing in Afghanistan and Yemen, etc. So I'll encourage people to go read that. Anything else, Matt, before we sign off?
Sure. Last thought. Maybe one of the next times we do something like this, we'll actually be talking about how the peace negotiations are going, because that would be very good.
Yeah, I'm not holding my breath, but I do hope that we are going to see something like that in the very near future, because I'm worried. I'm not going to lie. I'm very worried. But Matt, it's been great. As always, love discussing these topics with you. And to everyone else out there, we appreciate you listening. We'll catch you next time on In the Context of Empire.